Aloha. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. Hawaii County is considering changes to its affordable housing policy. We'll talk live with one of the key lawmakers leading the discussions. We learn more about a Pennsylvania resident buying up land on the Big Island and the local response to his plans to host an annual festival. We celebrate the 250th birthday of Jane Austen. The English writer remains popular around the world and has some points that remain very relevant today. And spies in Honolulu? A daughter unearths a never-before-told story about her father's family who lived here working undercover for Imperial Japan. A new book tells some of the secret history behind Pearl Harbor. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Affordable housing has to be at or near the top of any list of needs for the people of Hawaii. Those housing needs stretch across the islands, and while some of the structure starts with federal guidelines, each county manages its own housing programs. And Hawaii County is looking to change some of its affordable housing rules. Over the past few weeks, there have been community meetings, summits about this topic, with the latest one wrapping up late yesterday afternoon in Hilo. One of the leaders of this discussion is third-term Hawaii County Council member Ashley Kirkowitz. She has graciously stepped out of a committee meeting this morning to join us live to talk about the latest developments. Council member, first of all, thanks for joining us. And secondly, how's it been going with your community outreach on adjusting the county rules on affordable housing?
Good morning, Bill. Aloha from Hawaii Islands. We have had some really excellent conversations with community partners, government agencies, builders over the last couple of months. And so I think it's been awesome that we've had the opportunity to socialize, you know, some draft code changes, and the responses by community have been very well received.
What, you know, I know that you've been working on this a year and a half or so over the longer term. What has surprised you along the way, and especially as you get to the community outreach part of this?
Yeah, so this is the second ad hoc that I'm leading. Last year, we spent some time really thinking about how has Chapter 11, that's our affordable housing policy, worked for our community? Where are some gaps, where are opportunities to refine and clarify? And so this year, we spent a lot of time meeting twice a month, sometimes even more, for hours at a time to put pen to paper to actually write code. And that's what we've socialized with community. When we met with folks last year, you know, the intention was let's have a conversation about increasing supply, preserving existing stock, creating pathways and tools so that local families can realize home ownership, and then this big mindset shift around embracing housing developers as partners, not necessarily as adversaries. And so when we talked about Chapter 11, what was really hard to ignore was all the other aspects that contribute to the housing ecosystem, things like construction costs, infrastructure demands, and, you know, just other financial feasibility barriers for affordable housing projects. And so this bill, it doesn't solve everything with our housing need, but I think it's a major structural progress forward for our county.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the developer piece of this, and a common theme with affordable housing, whether it's in Hawaii or anywhere in the country, but certainly especially in Hawaii, that line from developers about this has to be able to make financial sense for us. And in an environment where they are facing rising costs, what are you looking at to make that mechanism work better in Hawaii County?
So I'd like to think that our bill is going to be removing constraints and then setting up real catalysts for production. A few years ago, I introduced an ordinance to set up the Affordable Housing Production Fund, where we're contributing at least $5 million in our annual budget to go towards housing development. That's literally a drop in the bucket. So we're looking to triple that investment and put in the code exactly the kinds of things folks can do with that, you know, build units, acquire land, rehabilitate existing stock, even invest in housing infrastructure, and remind me to talk a little bit about infrastructure in a little bit. We're also looking at expedited and coordinated permitting review outside of the traditional building division. So if it's an affordable housing project, making sure those folks get an expedited review with experts that are in the Office of Housing and Community Development, and that'll be their sole focus. One thing that is, I think, a cool innovation is this section on by right exemption. So we're all familiar with the 201H policy framework that allows folks to, get some relief from code and statute if they commit to building, you know, at least half of the project at an affordable rate. Mm-hmm. We're looking to put some of those exemptions in the code so that we're welcoming developers to kind of take advantage of that so that they develop and they don't have to go through that very arduous, bureaucratic, heavy paperwork process of the 201H.
You mentioned in terms of the paperwork side for the developer side, on the demand side with folks just looking to get into housing, especially for the first time, you know, it's a familiar issue, but the down payment issue, I know this is something mm-hmm. that you've been looking at. Any sort of way forward on this or sort of key to unlock that piece of the puzzle?
You know, I have friends and family members that are doing everything right. They work hard, they put money away, and when it comes time to actually start looking at purchasing a home, they just can't do it. They can't compete with folks that are coming into the islands, buying sight unseen, cash over asking price. And so the things that we've heard from community members, from local realtors, from lending institutions, from CDFIs is the down payment assistance. So one of the programs that we're going to be able to be running and scaling up and beefing up more through the Affordable Housing Production Fund is the down payment assistance program.
So on that, the down payment important in terms of the people trying to get into housing, the incentives for developers to build affordable housing rather than high-end housing that they can sell for cash to people, getting those incentives together, where are you seeing agreement that has maybe taken you by surprise or that gives you a base to push this all forward in a productive way?
I think folks just want to get it done, and I think they're appreciating the fact that Hawaii County is convening these conversations so that we can all work on this issue together. I don't want to assume that I know what a lender needs or a developer needs, and I also don't want them to make assumptions about the constraints that I'm under as a government official. And so I think everybody coming together and understanding each other's perspectives has resulted in policy shifts. This draft code, I think even like the mindset of how government operates. And so people are walking away from these conversations feeling like something good is going to come out of my time, my investment here. Government's actually listening and they're taking into consideration potential adverse impacts and they're willing to make adjustments based on what, you know, our experiences as developers or lending institutions has been. And I think that's a real sweet spot that we're hitting here.
You mentioned that you wanted to make a point about infrastructure.
Yes. Thank you for asking me about that. So one of the things that the state legislature provided the county's authority around was leveraging some of the GET, the general excise tax for housing infrastructure. Years ago, the council adopted an ordinance so that funding could be used for highways and mass transit. The bulk of our funding, close to $70 million, goes to mass transit right now. And I know that there is a potential sunset of our ability as counties to utilize this funding. So earlier this year, I introduced an ordinance. The council adopted it around using some of that GET for housing infrastructure, because when we've had these meetings with developers, that is the singular, you know, biggest expense that they're having to grapple with, that, you know, often adds to the cost of development. So what we're pushing for is while we're able to leverage this authority, at least for the next 5 years, of the county coming up with some kind of infrastructure investment plan so that we have this pot of money to utilize to put in the infrastructure that's necessary to make it more appetizing for developers or for anyone really here living here. to build homes at a more affordable price point.
You know, talking about developers and about mortgages and people looking for affordable housing, there's also the side of affordable rentals. Yes. Anything that's moving in that area?
There are definitely going to be rental assistance programs, and we've also made some changes to our real property tax code that I think will be more of an incentive for folks to look at positioning any like housing that they might have to be like a long-term rental for local families. It's braiding a number of different solutions together to make this all work. There isn't just, you know, one silver bullet that's going to solve all of our problems. And so I'm proud of the work that's kind of happened over years. There's been a lot of tinkering, a lot of different pulling of levers, and I'm hoping that at the end of the day, 5, 10, 20 years from now, we can look back and say, okay, we did good.
Ashley Kirkwitz working on it. We've been hearing live from Hawaii County Council member Ashley Kirkwitz working on adjusting the county's affordable housing rules. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill. Take care. Aloha.
Aloha.
Support for HPR comes from the Hanahauʻoli School Professional Development Center, specializing in progressive education workshops and teacher education at hanahauʻoli.org/PDC.
As cities grow, they often run into problems like pollution and lack of infrastructure, but city planners in Shenzhen, China, hired architects to address those things before they even happened.
They encouraged the clients to have the courage to confront the future and ask questions how things could be done differently.
Hear that story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Pennsylvania resident is now one of the largest private landowners in the state of Hawaii. Andrew Tepper has stirred controversy for hosting an annual festival inspired by Burning Man on property zoned for agriculture. But less attention has been paid to Tepper's recent land acquisitions on Hawaii Island. Christine Hitt is the Hawaii contributing editor for the online website SF Gate. Hitt spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about her reporting into Andrew Tepper's festival and land ownership.
Let's take a step back for a second and just give our listeners context about Falls on Fire, what this event was planned to be, and the types of controversy that it created.
Yeah, so Falls on Fire is marketed as like a Burning Man style event. If you're familiar with the event that happens in Nevada every year, it's basically would include overnight camping, music, DJs, and then it would kind of end with a burning ceremony of an effigy, just like Burning Man. So they're hoping to make it like a multi-day long festival.
But there was a problem, which was that they didn't go through permitting.
Yes. So they didn't have the proper permits. This is agriculturally zoned land. So with that said, they were hit with different violations. Some neighbors complained, some didn't. I think there's a mix of opinions about the event, but now they are looking to get the proper permits. They submitted it in September for a special use permit, and that decision should be coming up shortly.
And so you looked into Andrew Tepper. What sorts of things did you learn about him?
Yeah, so for the first thing that I did was I kind of dug into the different land purchases. I'm not sure what his history in Hawaii is, but he first comes on the scene in 2021 That's when he purchases three parcels. You got the large one that's like about 13,000 acres. And then you have two smaller ones at about 1,500. And then that's about when, you know, he started planning the Burning Man style event Falls on Fire. Aside from that information, there isn't a whole lot out there on him, like who he is and, you know, his background, what he does. And so the only real facts that I found were, you know, looking into newspaper archives when he owned like a software development company, learning that he, you know, graduated at Carnegie Mellon in Pennsylvania. He started a game development studio called eGenesis. I'm not familiar with these types of games, but they're called MMORPG games. And one also in 2013, which was a casino that uses cryptocurrency. I also saw that he had purchased other large properties on the East Coast, including Dream Mountain Ranch in West Virginia, which is 1,100 acres. So it's kind of like looking into like, what is his history with land? What does he tend to do with the land? And kind of get a sense of maybe what his intentions are. But I did reach out to him and, you know, he did tell me, this was through email, that, you know, he just loves agricultural land. So that's his words on why he's so interested in these parcels.
Sorry, what? What do you make of that?
I mean, it is clear that he is buying large pieces of land. I mean, he bought that one for 13,000, you know, north of Hilo. And then he just recently bought like around 800 acres, also a ranch, Kupayanaha Ranch. And then, you know, out in the East Coast, you know, that was 1,100 acres. And I also saw that he bought a Girl Scout camp, you know, a large property again. So I'm not sure what someone would do with that much land. It seems like it appeals to him in some way.
And this now places him in kind of the rankings of some of the large wealthy landowners here. He owns more land than, for instance, Mark Zuckerberg, but less than Larry Ellison. So somewhere along that continuum.
Yeah, and that's what kind of prompted me into diving into it, because I was like, yeah, he owns more than Zuckerberg. So I think that's worthwhile kind of looking into this as a story.
What sorts of questions do you still have about all of this, about Andrew Tepper and the land he owns and the gatherings he may or may not be planning on that land?
I guess, you know, just like everyone else, every time someone buys a large property, there's always a question of like, what is it going to be used for? What can it be used for? Could special permits be altered to include any type of development? You know, those are always, you know, thoughts that come up. You know, is this event going to move forward? You know, there's concerns like, well, what if it grows even more like Burning Man? Like, you know, I think there's thousands and thousands of people who go to Burning Man each year. So how will that affect the land there, the community there, the environment? I think there's a lot of environmental questions that I didn't get to address in the story, including, you know, they're playing with fire, literally. So, you know, what is that going to do to the environment around it, even if it is on about 15 acres is what it called for in the special use permit?
That was SF Gate reporter Christine Hitt and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to Hitt's story on our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We heard from many of you during our call-in show yesterday about the future of golf in Hawaii, and we plan to highlight your feedback in an upcoming segment. In the meantime, we're testing your knowledge today of notable architecture with the Hawaii connection. The architect Frank Lloyd Wright is known for designing more than 1,000 structures, two of which were built here in the islands. Cornwell House in Kamauela was initially designed as a single-family home for a Pennsylvania family. Similarly, the King Kamehameha Golf Club in Waikapu was meant for a few other locations, including Fort Worth, Texas, Acapulco, Mexico, and Roxbury, Connecticut. The Roxbury couple caught our eye. For today's quiz, can you name the actor and playwright couple for whom the King Kamehameha Clubhouse was originally designed? If you know the answer, call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NareitHawaii.com.
Fans of Jane Austen are celebrating the English novelist's 250th birthday this weekend with a day of Regency-era festivities at the Hawaii State Library. Now, what would Mr. Darcy say? Bob Newell founded the Hawaii chapter of JASNA, which stands for the Jane Austen Society of North America. He and current president Cheryl Ernst spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about their ties to Jane Austen, starting with their first introductions to her work. Newell starts us off with a production of Pride and Prejudice he saw in the eighth grade.
There was something in Pride and Prejudice that I took away, even as a young teenager, about relationships. And that's kind of colored my view for my whole life about what relationships are all about. It's made me a fan for life and will continue on.
Cheryl, what about you?
Well, I think my first copy of Pride and Prejudice, which seems to be the book that a lot of people start with, was one of those scholastic book order forms in sixth grade. Just fell in love with it. I read through it very quickly, of course, focused on the plot at that age, and have reread it I don't know how many times since, because the writing is so good. Each time as I got older, I appreciated the writing, the wit, found out that there were other books by the same author, so went through all of them, have read them all multiple times. Did some English literature in college, got to focus on the books, and just have never stopped.
And Cheryl, now that you've kind of taken on the helm of this chapter, what about it speaks to you, or what are the sorts of things that you help organize that you feel like really are meaningful for the chapter members?
Well, what's really fun about the chapter is that there are people from all walks of life. We have a Supreme Court justice retired who's a member. We have an accountant. We have teachers. We have retirees. Some regions have people who are really focused on academic study of Jane Austen. But the wonderful thing about JASNA is, as an umbrella, it's for anyone from someone who's only seen Colin Firth and can't forget the scene at the pond, to people who really want to delve into Jane Austen's life and her writings that aren't as well known. We've been trying to do more book discussions, both revisiting the novels that Jane Austen wrote. We did one on her juvenilia, her writings as a young person, which are a lot of fun, very snarky. We've done fan fiction. There's a myriad out there, continuations of her story, backstories of other characters. There are people that have adapted her stories. You know, people think, oh, it's Regency England. How applicable is that? But the relationships, the human foibles that she writes about, all those things, we all know people like that. So it's been fun to read things from Indian, Pakistani culture. There's one for young adults. that's African-American characters in Cleveland, I think, is the city. So there's a myriad of books out there that we can revisit.
And I saw that two of those books are written by you, Bob. You authored novels in 2016 and 2017, the first of which was this time travel romance, and the second was a retelling of Mansfield Park.
Mansfield Park, right.
Both of those have strong Hawaii angles, and I was wondering if you could talk about bridging those two subject matters and cultures and some of the fun overlaps or translations you were able to include in either of your works.
Sure. Well, really, it speaks to the fact that Jane Austen is universal and universal throughout the ages. You can only make these adaptations because she still has something to say today. So I took that and added my own ideas to it. And the time travel fantasy was a sort of a pure fun thing, but it was not exactly autobiography, but wishful thinking. That story was about a fellow who had trouble with relationships and lost himself in Jane Austen as compensation, then came to Hawaii to, of all things, a meeting of the Jane Austen Society. Maybe one day that'll actually happen, we don't know. And went to Chinatown and ended up with these magical potions that took him back in time to various points in Jane's life. And I took the idea of the life of Jane and combined that with what he was looking for in his own life and what she was looking for in her own life. And it mostly worked. It got reasonable reviews, so I won't complain.
I really enjoyed Bob's book, Hanai, which tells the story of not an orphan. She's from a family that has limited circumstances and is adopted by a wealthy Haole family. And the way he's woven in aspects of modern Hawaiian cultural relationships into this basic story that Jane Austen wrote, 200 years ago, is just masterful. It was a lot of fun to read.
Thank you.
Yeah, really drilling down into that, I like your point, Bob, that there's something universal about Jane Austen's writing or her ability to sense dynamics. And so I wonder, like, what emerges from that localization, or what about Hanai you really enjoyed, just that it was familiar circumstances?
Well, it was that it was a familiar story, but set in places that at that time I had not visited England, which since then I've been on an Jasna tour of Jane Austen sites in England. But I've been to Waianae, so I could picture what was happening. Certainly the sense of family. Family is an important theme, both functional and dysfunctional, in Jane Austen literature. So looking at that in a local sense, those kinds of parallels were the fun things to pick out.
250 years, right? We're celebrating Jane Austen's 250th birthday in just a few weeks. I would love if each of you could reflect a little bit on what that milestone means and what you're thinking about and the ways in which her works still ring true today. 250 years, that's a long time.
Well, I think it speaks to the importance of good writing and the fact that it's enduring, that people could appreciate the language, the wit, have a desire to, gosh, I wish I could pen something that clever. The chance to look at relationships. Certainly Jane Austen lived in a political time. There were wars going on most of her life. Two of her brothers ended up as admirals of the Navy, saw war. She doesn't talk directly about these things, slavery, abolition movements, but there are references to them in her work. So the more that I learn about her times and her life and how these things interrelated, the more I can appreciate historically and how some of the lessons learned then are still applicable today.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think it's important to know that she was one of the early feminists. She was truly a feminist and very concerned about the condition of women in Regency England. And if you look at the time between then and now, in each era, she's really had something to say to that era. And I spoke earlier about universality, and that's really what it is. Whether it was perhaps later on in the 1820s or 1850s, she had something to say. Towards World War I, you know, there were the Jainites, the Rudyard Kipling thing. She had something to say there. She had something to say later on, and she has a whole lot to say to us today. So 250 years, but 250 years of complete success.
What would she have to say right now? Or what do you take away right now from what she's written?
I think she'd be very in tune with the women's movement right now. I think that would probably be the biggest thing. And beyond that, her insights into human nature are as valid now as they ever were.
Well, self-discovery. None of her heroes or heroines are perfect people. They all have flaws. So how we can address our own flaws and that there's hope for us, that we can still have a happy ending, even if we've made mistakes. Those are hopeful.
Yeah, that there's redemption. Let's talk about the event that's on December 6th.
Sure. We're going to celebrate Jane Austen's birthday, and it will be at the Hawaii State Library, the downtown branch by Iolani Palace, from 1 to 4 p.m., and we're going to have some Regency-era dancing and card games. No experience required. People can learn at the event. We're going to have a photo booth, tea, book exchange, just lots of fun things, trivia game, lots of fun things going on, costume contest, but costumes are not required. And we just hope that a lot of people come out and maybe borrow a book, share their Jane Austen story, or if they've never read Jane Austen, maybe think about picking up one of the books to read. And I do want to give a big thank you to the Hawaii State Library for hosting us. They've gone great guns and are providing a lot of support. And the Friends of the Library of Hawaii has provided some funding to make the event possible and make it free to the public.
If either of you had to give a pitch to a student who's maybe just read Jane Austen as part of a curriculum, what's your pitch for why they should take a closer look or really think about what she has to say?
I would say put yourself in the picture. Imagine yourself as a member of this family or this group of friends. What role would you play? What would you do? And I do, excuse me if I digress for a minute, because you mentioned students, for the rest of this year, the Jane Austen Society is offering free membership to students. So any high school or college student who's interested, they have film contest, essay contest, resources for students who might be doing a term paper. If people just look up JASNA, JASNA.org, they can find information about that. Bob, what do you think? What would your message to young people be?
It would be, hey, read it again and ask yourself what you're learning about yourself while you're reading it. That, to me, is one of the big benefits of what Jane has written. That if you read it carefully, and maybe read it a couple of times, you can learn so much about yourself. So I would invite them to engage in that sort of an exercise. And I think 9 times out of 10, they'd be hooked.
Bob Newell and Cheryl Ernst talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. A celebration of Jane Austen's 250th birthday coming this Saturday, December 6th, at the Hawaii State Library. Look for links on our website after today's show.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, developing tailored energy conservation solutions. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
HPR is celebrating the season with special programming on HPR 1 and HPR 2. See the full lineup at hawaiipublicradio.org/holiday. Sponsored by Maui Fruit Jewels as a gift to the community.
Support for HPR comes from Treehouse with gifts for photographers, including disposable cameras, Polaroids, camera bags, and photo books at Salt Kaka'ako or treehouse-shop.com.
Now it's time to plot out the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about two Hawaii buildings designed by architect Frank Lloyd Wright, Cornwell House and the King Kamehameha Golf Course Clubhouse. Wright did not intend for either design to be built in Hawaii. The golf clubhouse in particular went through several iterations before its construction in Waikapu, Maui. Architect John Rattenbury combined three of Wright's designs meant for Texas, Mexico, and Connecticut. We asked you to name the famous Connecticut couple that commissioned Wright to design them a home. The pair divorced soon after, and the plans were left unfinished for decades before they were turned into the golf clubhouse. The names we were looking for? Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe. A lot of folks called in with Marilyn Monroe, but the first to match her with Arthur Miller, Paul Pizzina in Kula, Maui. So we have a tote bag headed for upcountry. If you want to listen back to our call-in show about the future of golf in Hawaii, you can head to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's also good for a quiz.
A fine romance, my good fellow. You take romance, I'll take jello.
We end today's show with a never-before-told story of the espionage that led to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Author Christine Kuhn didn't know much about her family growing up, but a stranger's letter led her to discover that her grandfather, grandmother, and aunt were all spies for the Japanese. The family was instrumental in gathering intelligence in Hawaii prior to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Her grandfather, Otto, was found guilty of spying in Honolulu, and her father, Eberhard, was a Punahou teenager who was taken with his family to the Sand Island detention camp. Christine Kuhn went on a three-decade journey to unearth and wrestle with the dark secrets of her family's past. She spoke with Conversation's Lillian Song about her new book, Family of Spies.
My father didn't talk much about my family growing up, and it was always hard for me to get straight answers. He sometimes even dodged questions completely, and I never really understood why he was so secretive. All I really knew is that his parents had passed. He did have a sister that lived in New York, and he grew up in Hawaii. So that's kind of the three tiers that he would talk about. So in 1994, I was married. I had two toddlers still in diapers when I received a letter from a Hollywood screenwriter. The letter talked about my family, specifically my grandfather, who was a major player in the Nazi Party and involved in the bombing of Pearl Harbor as a spy for the Japanese. And I was just totally confused. I had no idea what he was talking about. So I called my dad, and he assured me it was a mistake. And my father, no way, it has to be someone else. So, you know, I sat there for a little while and we talked, and I told him I was going to do some research and would let him know what I found. He said, great, and I'll talk to you later. And he hung up. I don't know, it was about 10 or 15 minutes later, he called me back and he was sobbing. I mean, I hadn't seen my father cry like that, even when my mom passed away. And he, you know, took a while, and he would gather himself, and then he would get upset again. But he finally told me the whole story. That was the first time I had ever heard about my family's history, their involvement with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, I knew he was from Berlin, but I didn't know they were involved with the Nazi Party. So it was a pretty powerful moment for me, and one that kicked off a 30-year journey where I was trying to uncover the history of my family's past.
That's quite a moment, Christine, for him to actually start revealing those stories. Stories that in the past were closed off to you.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. My dad always made up crazy stories, right? He was always telling us stories about a lost boy on the highway or alligators, you know, coming out of the woods in the backyard. And, you know, when you were little, you believed the stories your father tells you. And as I got older, I realized, you know, these aren't real. This was just him making up stories for entertainment. As I uncovered more information about my father, their involvement with the Nazi Party in Germany, moving to Hawaii in 1935 to, you know, basically come as a sleeper spy for the Japanese and gather intel for them, I realized that my father told me those stories because they were easier than telling me his real life. That was how he compartmentalized what had happened to him as a young child. And it, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking to think that your father can't tell you your history.
It was his older sibling, his sister, half-sister Ruth, who was a big part of this spy ring, and his parents. Introduce the family members to our listeners.
So my grandfather's name was Otto, and he became a high-ranking member of the Nazi Party. Crazy, he even interviewed to be head of the Gestapo in Germany. My grandmother, Friedel, was kind of like the matriarch of the family. And my uncle Leopold joined the party as a stormtrooper. And he eventually worked for Joseph Goebbels in the Ministry of Propaganda, which was how Ruth ended up getting connected with Goebbels. She had an affair with Goebbels when she was only 17 years old, which I think was one of the main reasons the family ended up in Hawaii. You know, Ruth was half Jewish, and with the Nuremberg laws going into effect, banning relationships between Germans and the people of Jewish descent, Goebbels was forced to conceal his misdeed. You know, he had to kind of get rid of the evidence that he had had an affair with someone who was half Jewish. And at that time, the Japanese were looking for Caucasians to place in Hawaii as sleeper spies. The whole entire Kim family had a strong connection with the Goebbels faction of the Nazi Party. So it kind of made sense for Otto to be tapped on the shoulder to go, and he could take Ruth with him. And so the entire family, except for Leopold, who stayed in Berlin, moved to Hawaii and got involved in spying for the Japanese.
Wow. And so the older Kiwins, they're adults. And so they are set in ideology, their understanding of politics. But the younger ones, like your dad and his younger brother, they're swept along because these are family ties.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Someone asked me one time, who are the people that you truly care about in this story? And it's my dad and his younger brother, Hans. I mean, they were forced into a situation. You know, you go with your family, you love your family, but they were forced into a situation that took them down a path they never expected. I mean, I don't think Hans ever fully recovered. I mean, he went back to Germany with Friedel and Ruth on the last prisoner exchange of the war, but he was damaged. He ended up getting married and having three sons, but he met his wife in a hospital because he had tried to commit suicide. And, you know, eventually he succeeded, you know, because I just think he couldn't live with what the family had done to him.
Here in Hawaii, history is nuanced. History, though, has to be written down or learned about. If you don't hear about it, it doesn't exist. When your book came onto our radar, this was so surprising because in Hawaii, we hear about the internment camps and we know that the Japanese were interned. We knew that there were, you know, Italians, Germans, but they were just like numbers and statistics. But with your story, with your family's history, they become real people. And the way your book is written and how you take us back into a different time, people were more innocent, more naive in a sense with intelligence, not realizing that all this was being collected to be used against them.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a fascinating story. And to know that it's an untold, unknown piece of history. I mean, I hear that from people that read it and say, wow, I had no idea that anyone was ever tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which was my grandfather. You know, they didn't know any of that. You know, you talk about the ease of espionage. I mean, I think about when they were sending messages back and forth to Japan from the Japanese consulate, they would go over to the Western Union and send a telegram, right, with information. It wasn't even a secret. I mean, it was open to the public. Anyone could have read it because we just didn't have all that intelligence that we have today. I mean, I think the micro dot technology was just coming into view during this time period. So you're right. It was, You walk down the street and you counted the boats that were in the dock. You go to, you know, I think there's a tea room there. Back then it was called Sun Chow Row Tea House, and now it's called Natsa Nona Tea House. I think that's actually even still there. They would go to this tea house and look out over through the telescope there and out over the water to be able to capture information about, you know, what ships were out to sea, what ships were in harbor. You drove around the island and you got all the intel you needed. There wasn't a whole lot of hidden espionage happening in Hawaii during that time.
A remarkable story from right here in Hawaii. We've been hearing from Christine Kuhn, author of the new book, Family of Spies. She's been talking with HPR's Lillian Song about discovering her family's involvement in World War II as spies for the Japanese. We'll have more of their conversation after this break. Let's get back to our conversation with author Christine Kuhn. Her new book, Family of Spies, is the true story about Kuhn's family, who were spies for the Japanese before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The book has won praise from Publishers Weekly. The New York Times calls it an amazing and gripping tale, and it's on their list of most anticipated titles this fall. Kuhn spoke with HPR's Lillian Song. She picks up the story after first hearing from a filmmaker interested in developing her family's story into a movie. She describes the research process she then undertook with her husband, Mark.
It was really funny. You know, the night afterwards, we drove over to Borders Books and we started looking through the World War II section. And I looked through, you know, numerous books and I didn't see anything. I didn't see Otto's name in there. And I was like, well, maybe this historian is really off. Maybe he's misinformed. And I look over and I can tell by Mark's face, he's reading something and he looks up and waves me over. It was the book At Dawn We Slept. And there he is in black and white, everything he had done. Otto Bernard Julius Kuhn. I just remembered taking that and then looking at half a dozen other books and finding him listed in other books as well. You know, there was no internet. You had to kind of go out and do it yourself. I went to the Mormon temple. I wanted to make sure that this Kuhn family was definitely my family. They have one of the largest genealogy libraries in the country. They still do today. But I put it away, Lillian. I mean, it was a hard story. I didn't want to be related to this family. It wasn't my belief. I mean, I grew up with my dad, you know, celebrating Veterans Day and hanging your flag on the 4th of July. So I didn't tell people about it. It was hard and difficult to comprehend that, you know, I have a family history that could have done this and a family that did this. So, you know, the research would start and stop. Some days I couldn't even begin to imagine what I was learning. But, you know, we would go to the archives and we would scour through files and try and make heads of tails of all the documents. And there were often conflicting reports. I mean, we found memos from Hoover about the investigation of Otto. And then we would find memos to Roosevelt from the Attorney General talking about Otto's trial and what happened. We would look at all kinds of old articles that talked about Ruth and Otto leading the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was totally untrue. And then, you know, we even reached out to the University of Hawaii and got the Kuhn family papers that included lots of letters from Otto and my father back and forth with the Weavers and some family friends. So it was kind of all around, right? We had to go to the archives. We read books. We, you know, eventually after a few years after my aunt passed away in 2010, Facebook started coming alive. So I was able to start researching and trying to find my family through social media. And it wasn't until 2020 when my cousin Lisa actually wrote me a letter. I didn't even know she existed to tell me. She wanted to tell me about the Otto Kuhn family if I was interested. Again, that just, all the floodgates opened again for about the 10th time over 30 years. And a couple months after that, I received a outreach from a historian who was writing you know, gathering information about the Kuhns because he wanted to write a book. I stopped right there. And I remember clearly looking at Mark. We were in the car driving and I looked at him and I said, if anyone's going to tell my family story, it's going to be me. I want to create the narrative of my family story and make sure it's told right. Once again, back down rabbit holes. We started our research, started the writing process, which was daunting in itself. And here we are today.
30 years, it goes by fast, but at the same time, it's so rich and detailed.
It wasn't an easy task for me, right? Trying to understand what your family had done and the transgressions of the past. And so it took a long time to come to terms with that and understand that what my family had done was not a reflection on who I was. It wasn't honestly a reflection on who Dad was. I mean, my dad, when he got out of the internment camp, he never saw his mother again. He walked away from his family. He stayed in Hawaii. He graduated high school, denounced his German citizenship. He joined the U.S. Army and fought in Okinawa. And, you know, that I think of my father as a hero. But, you know, in the end, I'm really glad that I was able to get that story out there. I hear from people saying they don't like history, and maybe they would have learned more about history if it had been written like this. You know, I really hope as I think about what I want people, what do I want them to take away from this? And I honestly hope anyone who reads Family of Spies walks away with the same realization that I have come to. And we all carry pieces of our family's past, but we're not defined by our family's actions, especially those of past generations. We are responsible for our own future, and we have the power to choose who we want to become. And I think my dad did that. You know, he changed history. He said, I can change what I want my future to be. And he did it. And so it gave me the understanding that I'm not the reflection of my grandparents. I'm actually a reflection of my father and his ability to walk away from his family and knowing he'd never see them again, but to create a different path for him and a different path for us.
Author Christine Kuhn talking with HPR's Lillian Song. Kuhn writes of her 30-year journey uncovering her family history in a newly published book titled Family of Spies, a World War II story of Nazi espionage, betrayal, and the secret history behind Pearl Harbor. Look for links on our website after the show. That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow we take a closer look at the bus system on Hawaii Island. Rides will stay free, but the transit budget is tight. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Bill Dorman, and today for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.